This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Thursday afternoon, the team that has tied the National Hockey League record for best start ever skated through a brief practice at TD Bank North Garden in Boston. By winning their first 10 games this season, the Buffalo Sabres streaked to the top of the Northeast Division of the Eastern Conference. Buffalo's early success was not entirely surprising, according to Paul Hamilton, who covers the team for WGR Radio in Buffalo. He maintains that the Sabres streak really began after a 6-1 loss to Ottawa last November that dropped Buffalo to 9 losses against only 8 wins.
From that point forward, it's absolutely phenomenal. They had picked up like 33 out of 37 points or something like that last year. It was in that range. They have team meeting after the game. Every single player was in that room when the media came in to take responsibility for what was going on. Not one player had left. And that was like the starting point. And they really haven't had that lull since then.
The success that is the Sabres these days could be said to have begun even earlier, several years ago, in fact, when the team started remaking itself as a high-speed, up-tempo unit, figuring that the grab-the-other-guy's-flashy forward-and-slow-him-down style of play was on the way out. Buffalo turned out to be right, and the results have been spectacular, though Maxim Ufinaganov, a right winger with half a dozen goals and 11 assists to his credit in the young season, is inclined to talk about the winning streak in hackneyed terms.
You know, you just take one game at a time, you know, and try to win the game you're playing. You try don't think about the other games right now. And, you know, we lost the last game against Atlanta, you know, we just want to forget that and get on roll again and win the games.
How do you say take it one game at a time in Russian?
Одна игра за одной.
So did you know that cliche in Russian before you learned it in English?
Yeah. The coach is talking all the time like that, you know.
Speaking of head coaches and cliches, Buffalo's mentor of the past 10 seasons, Lindy Ruff, has faced an intriguing challenge this time around. I asked him after Thursday's practice whether he'd just been telling his players, hey, you're going great, just keep doing what you're doing.
No, I think there are things that you have to pay attention to game in, game out. I think those areas in the games are areas that we work hard and practice at, but you know, we want to continue to have good habits. I think we've had situations in games where, you know, I think our habits have gotten, you know, a little bit careless. But then there's also times where we've been very good throughout those games. And you know, I think the core of that message just keeps coming from the dressing room.
Okay, take it one game at a time, keep working on reinforcing the good habits, and heaven help us, stay on message. But when you win 10 games in a row to start your season, doesn't luck have to be riding your forward's hip and sitting on your goalie's shoulder? Ruff and his players acknowledged the team's good fortune, which led me to ask defenseman Nathan Paish if he was actually surprised when the Sabres finally lost their first game to the Thrashers last Saturday night.
And we knew it was going to happen eventually, but we only lost in a shootout. You know, it's not like we got killed or flat out lost. It's just every night guys come to play, and we have a confident group. And I think it's because we're confident in each other, and everybody knows that everybody's going to go out there and do their best to win a hockey game. And I think when everybody feels that way and they go into with the attitude that they're there to win, it makes it that much easier to win.
It also makes it easier to involve the fans back in Buffalo, who are more accustomed to cheering for their pro football team during the autumn, at least according to radio reporter Paul Hamilton.
They sold out a Tuesday game a couple of weeks ago, and that was unheard of a couple of years ago. Jeremy Rona came in with the Flyers. There are like 9,000-10,000 people in the building, and he goes, this is embarrassing. This is a complete embarrassment here. But now this team has caught on so much, they are threatening to sell out every game this year, and they have so far, and there are not a lot of tickets left as they go into the future now. You know, it's always been Bills, 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 and then the Bills are over and people start paying attention to the Sabres. Well, now people are starting to pay attention to the Sabres in October and November.
The Sabres overcame a 4-1 deficit in Thursday night's game to tie the Bruins, then went on to beat Boston in the shootout. With 23 points, Buffalo is the best team in the Eastern Conference, and their 58 goals scored leads the National Hockey League. The Sabres will attempt to establish a new winning streak of 2 when they host the Toronto Maple Leafs tonight.
Playoffs begin, and your team's in. Just stay cool and under control. But we all know, and you Sabre fans know, that was not a goal.
Will Ben Wallace rally the Bulls to post-Jordan greatness? Will Rasheed Wallace render the Rasheed Wallace rule obsolete before the All-Star break? And can Isaiah Thomas cause Knicks fans to stop pining for the heady days of the Herb Williams era? Joining me now on the line to discuss the 2006-2007 NBA campaign is Benjamin Hockman, who covers the league for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Ben, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
The Bulls, which many pundits agree made the best offseason move by acquiring center Ben Wallace, thoroughly embarrassed the 2006 champions on Halloween night. Is Chicago that good, or are the Miami Heat that tired?
I think it was just one game. I think at the end of the season, we're going to see both of those teams vying for the championship. I am excited just to watch the Bulls. For years, they've been just a lowly team. And now they've got some spark with Ben Wallace. And I really like P.J. Brown. I covered him. He played for the Hornets. And he's just a warrior down there. And it's going to be fun to watch that low post presence for the Bulls.
The Los Angeles Clippers, who made the playoffs last spring for the first time in 10 seasons, even won their first series ever, are expected to further improve this season. Are the Clips blips on the radar, or have Donald Sterling and Elgin Baylor finally engineered a Clippers dynasty?
Somehow they did. It's amazing. The Clippers are a hot team. They're an up-and-coming team. They picked up Tim Thomas in the offseason. I think that was a great move. They've got their core back. Sam Cassell is a great leader, a pass-first guy. Elton Brand, obviously, is an up-and-coming player. Chris Kaman got his contract figured out. I think this is going to be a fun, salty team to watch, and they can maybe make the conference finals.
There doesn't seem to be an early season consensus regarding which team or teams will dominate this year. As I see it, Miami, Dallas, San Antonio, Phoenix, Detroit, and Chicago have legitimate shots. Is Paul Mr. Parody Tagliabue secretly working for the NBA in his dotage?
Sounds like it. You're right. All those teams are legitimate contenders for the championship. I personally think that the Suns are the team to beat. I think with Amari back, and I think the coach, D'Antoni, just really, really knows that offense well and gets his guys to play the way he wants to. They've got some key cogs off the bench. And now with Amari back, like I mentioned, I think they're the cool team to beat. But talk to me in a few months.
Well, what about Dallas, San Antonio, Miami, Detroit, teams like that?
They're all good, don't get me wrong. And especially Dallas, as we saw in the finals last year, they were just a few minutes away from going up 3-0. I think they're all talented teams, but you get Amari back in that lineup for the Suns, and I just think they're the team to beat. But it's going to be fun to watch Dallas and San Antonio battle through the year in that division because they play each other a lot. And Tony Parker just had a fantastic year last year. I think he really went overlooked because there were so many other great point guards in the league last year, notably the Suns' Steve Nash. It's just going to be fun to watch these teams battle, but I really think the Suns will come out on top there.
Some have predicted that Orlando power forward Dwight Howard and New Orleans point guard Chris Paul are poised to have breakout seasons if they hadn't already. What other players will surprise this year?
Well, I look at Larry Hughes for the Cleveland Cavaliers. If he stays healthy, I think he and LeBron could be one of the best 1-2 punches in the NBA. Obviously, last year he missed a lot of time, and once he got back, the Cavaliers weren't the Cavaliers that we thought were going to make the playoff run. So keep your eye on Larry Hughes. And another guy, you mentioned breakout, but you look at Yao and you look at T-Mac. Obviously, they both established themselves as star players separately, but they haven't really done too much together. But last season, in the 31 games they played together, the Rockets were 21-10. I think a lot of people are overlooking the Rockets because of the division they're in with such great teams like the Spurs and the Mavericks. But I think they're such a playoff team.
The New York Knicks were 23-59 last season. They are paying over $63 million in salary to guys who are no longer on the team, and that doesn't include the mystery buyout figure for last year's head coach Larry Brown. They've given away first-round picks, gotten very little in return. Is it possible for Isaiah Thomas or for any coach to rescue the Knicks?
Well, I'm going to go with no. Red Auerbach passed away this week, and Phil Jackson's got another job. I mean, it's just a mess there, but I mean, they still have Steve Francis and Stephon Marbury in the backcourt. I want to say they're going to be a better team than last year, and I just can't see them making a push to the playoffs this year and basically any time in the aught decade.
You mentioned Red Auerbach, who died last Saturday at the age of 89. It seems that almost everyone here in Boston has a story to share regarding the man who had a hand in 16 Celtics championships. But what are people outside of Boston saying about Red Auerbach?
Well, I think the consensus is this is a guy that did so much for the game, more than just X's and O's. You looked at all the African-American players he put in the lineup, made Bill Russell a coach. I think everyone, from fan standpoint to even people, players in the league, talking to some of the New Orleans Hornets players, you know, they never met the man, but they know about the man and what he stood for, and everybody has a story. My favorite real quick was talking to Willis Reed, who works for the Hornets. When the Knicks were really bad, one year they were playing the Celtics, and in the first quarter the Knicks were down 30, and Red lit up a cigar.
The first quarter, I love it. This year the NBA has outlawed the histrionics, which seem to follow almost every foul call, but apparently the so-called Rasheed Wallace rule hasn't worked for Rasheed Wallace. He was ejected from a game on Wednesday for complaining to the officials. Is Wallace that out of control, or does he just appreciate irony?
Yeah, there it is. There it is. he'll sit down, and he'll, if he keeps this up and he realizes he's hurting his team, he'll probably take a deep breath, if that's possible. But, I mean, at least they're doing this because things were getting out of control. After every ticky-tack foul, there was a shouting match for 30 seconds, and it just looked bad for the game and looked bad for Rasheed Wallace.
All right, Benjamin, here are my NBA Finals predictions. Either the Toronto Raptors against the Los Angeles Clippers or the Orlando Magic against the New Orleans, Oklahoma City, or someplace else Hornets. What do you think?
From my end, I mentioned the Suns earlier, and I think Miami will do it again. So let's look at Miami Suns. But I mentioned the Clippers as well. I think they could honestly make a move and run to the conference finals but lose to the Suns.
Benjamin Ackman covers the National Basketball Association for the Times-Picayune of New Orleans. Ben, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce runs his mouth in our weekly sports dash. But first, 37,000 runners from more than 100 countries will participate in tomorrow's New York City Marathon. Of those, only about 45 have a realistic chance to win, and of those, the dozen or so Kenyan competitors are the likeliest laureates. In fact, Kenyan runners, male and female, have won 4 of this year's 8 major marathon titles. Those achievements have led some to search the globe for the secrets of their success. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
In a rented townhouse on the outskirts of Boulder, Colorado, the runners for Kimbia Athletics are taking a break from their marathon week training, relaxing to the sounds of Christian music videos they've brought from Kenya.
But we enjoy, this keeps us close to home. You know, you look outside and you're in America, and inside the house, you feel like you're at home.
Peter Tanui is not Kenya's best runner, but his talents were enough to get him a full-ride scholarship to Lubbock Christian University in Texas. The story of how Peter started running is a typical one.
We didn't have buses to go to school, so morning, evening, we ran back and forth from home to school. And coming, going in the morning, we kind of raced against each other. Coming back in the evening, we raced against the other kids, just for fun.
Kids aren't driven to school in Kenya. Their parents don't own cars. They can't necessarily afford shoes either. When Peter got older, a teacher from his secondary school introduced him to Ibrahim Hussein, who's best known for winning 3 Boston Marathons, and Peter's life changed.
And I remember sitting on his nice new Pathfinder, and it felt good to realize that this was the fruits of his labor in running. It feels so great. I think it changed my mind all around and made me realize that really with running and perseverance, you can do a lot of things.
When Peter is in the United States, he trains in Boulder. But when he's in Kenya, he trains in a town on the edge of the Rift Valley called Iten. If New York City is the epicenter for global capitalism, then Iten is the epicenter for distance running. Goats graze on the infield of Kamarni Showgrounds in Iten, elevation 8,000 feet. It's 10:30 on a Tuesday morning, and the track is full of runners doing speed work. The stadium isn't much to look at. The yellow and green paint is peeling off the concrete wall that surrounds it. Runners take shelter from the morning sun under 2 acacia trees, not under the collapsing roof of the stands. Anyone's best guess is that in this town of about 4,000 people, nearly 500 are runners. More than 200 earn their living as world-class professional athletes. The rest are struggling with no sponsor, no agent, no formal coach, and a limitless amount of hope.
We are still struggling. Maybe next year we'll be champions.
Ask any of the 60 or so runners here today, and they'll tell you they have the same dream, to be champions, except the ones who tell you they want to win an Olympic gold medal or set a world record. It might seem like they're aiming high, but in E10, people say that when you have faith, anything is possible, especially when it comes to running.
It has an awe, maybe, about it, or a kind of a feeling that people get, you know, that this is where so many champions have come from.
Brother Colm O'Connell knows a lot about faith. He's a member of a Catholic teaching order, and he's seen the faith runners have in E10.
When you kind of step on the track and start to think about the number of champions and the number of people who have taken steps on this track, you know, you begin to realize that it has a kind of an inspiration about it. It's the dirt and the dust and the cows walking across the track when you're training, and the whole atmosphere that is so sacred to these athletes.
Brother Colm came from Ireland to St. Patrick's Secondary School to teach geography in 1976. He stumbled into coaching what is quite possibly the world's most successful running program. Over the years, St. Patrick's has planted a tree for every athlete who's made it big on the international stage. Rumor has it that St. Patrick's Grove has more than 100 trees. O'Connell won't confirm.
Kenyans traditionally don't count things so much. They don't even count the number of children they have. When we plant it, you will see the earlier trees are large. Because I think at the time, we didn't realize we'd have so many athletes.
St. Patrick's didn't start out to be a running school and still admits students solely on the basis of academics, never athletics. In fact, even Brother Colm knew nothing about running when he came to E10. But St. Patrick's success could not be derailed by the likes of an amateur coach.
The athletes kept coming. The success kept coming. So we had to keep planting more and more trees. And eventually, we're going to end up with a forest here in our, right in our front garden.
So now you're planting bushes.
We're down to shrubs now. I don't know, maybe there'll be flowers next if they get any more crowded.
When O'Connell came here, St. Patrick's already had its first Olympic medalist. Mike Boyt led a total of 6 St. Patrick's alums with a bronze medal at the Munich Olympic Games. While the runners were already here, not everything else was. There was no bank, no electricity, no telephone, no running water. But as more and more athletes found success, many brought their fortunes back to E10.
Of course, you can see now camps have grown up, businesses have come to town, and many of the buildings you see around town are maybe owned by athletes.
But the athletes do more for E10's future than just building homes and sponsoring schools. At 6 o'clock on any given weekday, E10's dirt paths are clogged with runners and primary school children on their way to class. As the professional athletes go by, kids try to run alongside, sometimes just for a few feet and sometimes for as much as a kilometer. Brother Colm says by the time they make it to his junior running camps, E10's school children already know what it means to be a runner.
I'm sure many of them ran after Lorna, ran after Moses Kiptanui, Wilson Kipketer, and these guys have to train. These guys sweat like I do. These guys kick up dust like I do, you know. So why can't I be an athlete? You know, they're also human beings after all. You know, so I think that connection is made, you know, between the more established athletes and the younger kids coming up.
Even though he no longer teaches at the school, Brother Colm lives in a quiet little house on the grounds of St. Patrick's. He focuses now on training 3 professional athletes who also live on the grounds and entertaining foreign coaches who come to learn his secrets. But O'Connell says there is no secret.
People look for reasons as to why they're so good. So they talk about altitude and they talk about diet and they talk about even genetics and they talk about lifestyle. But very few people ever talk about the way they train. You know, they tend to ignore the fact that they train incredibly hard. Maybe in the Western world, sometimes we would prefer if there was another reason other than training.
Good morning.
Karibu sana.
Are you the last?
It's 2 hours before sunrise when I climb into the back of Lorna Kiplagat's covered truck to witness for myself the Kenyan commitment to training. Lorna's had a banner year. It's late September, and she's already set a world record in a 10-mile race in Amsterdam. But even though she's exhausted, she still has four more races this season. After about an hour and a half, Lorna's husband and manager, Peter Langerhorst, turns the truck down a rocky mining trail, and our ears pop as we descend. At the bottom, Peter offers a little advice to Lorna and the junior runners she's brought along.
Good luck. Because 2 weeks ago we had somebody with a complete blackout. I don't say who, but he was like, I don't see the road anymore. He was completely lost. So take it easy, okay?
For the next 47 minutes, the athletes run uphill from the Flosper mine. At an average grade of 7%, they climb 4,000 feet over 13 miles, the distance of a half marathon. Moses Tanui discovered this course years ago before winning two Boston marathons and a world championship in the 10,000 meters. Now runners travel for miles around to take on the challenge. Serious runners like Lorna tackle it every 2 weeks, and when she does, kids and adults alike come out of their homes to watch her go by.
It's often known that people who are training there, they are big names, they are big champions, they are Olympic champions, and somebody would think, oh, that's so-and-so, I think it is so-and-so, even if they don't know, I think I saw Lorna, I think it was Katrin. That's like the highlights of the day for the kids also. So people love running in Kenya. They really have respect, when you pass by as an athlete, people really, you motivate people.
Like many of the runners from the area, Lorna Kiplagat reinvests in the sport that's taken her from Kenya to the Netherlands to the United States and back. In Kenya, where girls are expected to forego school, get married, and stay home with their children, Lorna had a hard time finding a place to train. So a few years ago, she built her own high-altitude training center in E10 and has sponsored more than a dozen girls, training with them, counseling them, and paying their school fees.
My dream is just that they have a future, either in running or academically. Academically for me would be the best because, running, it's yes, you can do running for a few years. And if you get injured, then you have nothing at all. So I want them to combine it. I want to combine running as well as academics. Then they have something to fall back to.
Lorna and the girls while away an afternoon sitting on mattresses on the grass at the high-altitude training center, chatting and laughing, seemingly unaware that the clock is ticking to the next training session. Peter Langerhorst sits under the shade of a large umbrella, reading his paper. But to hear him tell the story, all this lightheartedness belies a very serious truth about runners in Kenya.
The difference is, in the U.S. and in Europe, we have so many opportunities. We have a lot of chances. If we can study, we can work, we can even decide to do nothing, especially in Europe, but not in Africa. You don't have chances, you don't have opportunities. So there are no choices. It's a way to get out, absolutely.
And to get out, Kenya's runners don't even have to win. In a country where the average annual income is $460, there's more than one way to make a living at running.
Yesterday was the Berlin marathon where Haile Gebrselassie tried to break the world record. And three of our athletes were pacemakers in the race. Every 2 weeks they run in a marathon and they try to set the pace for the top athletes. Well, if they do a very good job, they can make a few thousand dollars per race. So they go for 3 months to Europe or to the US and they come back with $10,000-$12,000, which is an awful lot of money. So they never finish a race, they never win a race, but they make a very good living.
You can do a whole host of things with $10,000.
University of Georgia professor of physical education and sports science, Rose Chebiater-Thompson, knows what it's like to be motivated by poverty. If it wasn't for running, she'd still be living in a small village near E10.
With $10,000, that is 800,000 Kenya shillings, you can build a house, you can buy a farm, you can send all your siblings to school, You can build a house for your parents.
When Chebyater Thompson came to the University of Madison, Wisconsin in 1979, she was so worried about losing her track scholarship that she'd sneak in an extra training session every morning at 11.
And then at 3:30, I'll show up with my teammates, with my coach coaching us. I didn't say, by the way, coach, I am really tired. I've been running today. I ran today at 11. No, I had to work really hard. So we have extra pressures. Anybody, any human being, if you are pressured to do something, if the door is locked, you have no choice but to find a window. And that window is running.
Over the past decade, more and more Kenyans have opened that window. The most striking example is the Boston Marathon, where Kenyan men have won 15 of the past 20 races, and Kenyan women have won 5 of the past 7. Those looking for a deeper secret to the success of Kenyan runners have made a pretty good case for a genetic component, showing a difference in such things as oxygen efficiency, calf size, fatty acid oxidation, and twitch fibers, especially in members of the Kalenjin tribe. Most involved with Kenyan runners discount the role of genetics, none more staunchly than Professor Chebyater Thompson.
We work so hard. I think there is a Kalenjin philosophy that says any work that you do, you have to make it so perfectly so when somebody sees, they think it comes natural. You work so hard, train so hard, so when somebody sees you running, they think it's magic. You fool them.
But it's not magic.
It's not magic.
It might not be magic, but for those who are convinced that the secret is more than just altitude, attitude, poverty, and a lot of hard work, Chebyater Thompson offers a simple solution.
Go to Kenya. Stay there. Live there. Move your family there. You see tennis families moving to Florida, where it's warm? Well, move your child to Kenya. You always welcome people. We welcome you anytime.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in E10 Kenya.
Last week's show featured my conversation with Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall about Major League Soccer's postseason, as well as a discussion with Anson Dorrance, the coach of the North Carolina women's soccer team. One Only a Game listener who didn't leave his name was delighted by that lineup.
I am driving at this very moment to the New England versus Chicago soccer playoffs in Gillette Stadium, and I picked up Only a Game. I hear a wonderful coverage for which our soccer fans will be eternally grateful.
Bill Caldwell, a WBUR listener, feels otherwise. I love your show, he wrote. I am a devoted listener, listening while I walk Nantasket Beach every Saturday morning. However, this past Saturday's show was an insult. It descended like a rock into tedious stories about professional bowling, professional soccer, women's soccer, and bicycling. I'll bet 85% of your listeners could care less about any of these endeavors. Not to be totally un-PC, but please try to remember that a lot of us like to hear your usually good stuff about baseball, football, basketball, and hockey. We're not Neanderthals, just sports nuts. Our numbers suggest that Mr. Caldwell is off by at least 25%, but we've got hockey, basketball, and football in this week's show, just in case. You can tell us what you think of the program by writing us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at bicon.com, BICON.com. And the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the new autobiography of Jim Brown, running back, civil rights activist, and figure of controversy. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Number 5, Louisville defeated number 3, West Virginia, on Thursday night, keeping the Cardinals' championship hopes alive. Will this also keep the Big East alive?
It was a very important game, win or lose either team, for the Big East. It was two undefeated teams, two fairly well-ranked teams, both of them still in the running for a BCS bowl at the end of the year. And Louisville proved to be a much better team than I thought they were.
SEC fans would argue that a handful of SEC teams stand a better chance of taking the BCS championship this season. Do you agree?
Well, the SEC fans may argue that, but they're going to wind up with a conference full of teams with one loss. If Louisville manages to get through the Big East schedule undefeated, you've got LSU playing Tennessee this weekend. If Tennessee loses, that gives them two losses. It could be possible the SEC will wind up with four or five teams with two losses. How much better are they, for example, just to name a local school, than Boston College, who might finish the year with one loss? But they also have to play an ACC championship game. So the
there's steam coming out of his ears. What should I do?
This happens to the BCS computer every year.
Which NFL games fall into the crucial category this weekend? And because I'm so conversant with football, I'm going to beat you to it. Colts versus Patriots, right?
Very good. Now, if you want to look really smart among the many football people that have come over to your house every Sunday to watch the NFL games at one of your famous parties, I would point out that the Cincinnati Bengals are playing at the Baltimore Ravens on Sunday in one of the early games. It's an important game for both teams. It's a really important game for the Bengals.
Chad Johnson is out about $5,000 this week after a new stunt. What did he do this time?
He did something funny, which the NFL
That'll
is completely revolted by. He put the phrase Ocho Cinco on the back of his jersey rather than his name, and he was fined $5,000. Don't you just think that the NFL is the living embodiment of Robin Williams' getaway line in Good Morning Vietnam about what you are more dire need of than any white man in history?
The National Basketball Association began play this week, Charlie. In Boston, players and sports writers from various eras gathered to pay tribute to former Celtics coach and general manager Red Auerbach, who died last Saturday. How will you remember Red Auerbach?
Well, I had three conversations with the man, and he was not pleasant in any of them. But I will remember him and what he accomplished as figure 1A with Branch Rickey in breaking down the barriers of race in sports. The Boston Celtics, despite what you may hear from Spike Lee and other New York apologists, had a record when it really counted on racial issues that is unmatched by any franchise in the history of sports. Red Auerbach was central to that. The fact that he was grumpy with me on three occasions doesn't matter a damn. What I do have an interesting, and I'm going to venture into ethnic propriety here for a minute. Part of the tribute, they had bagpipers playing Amazing Grace. They couldn't find one guy with a shofar.
On opening night, the defending NBA champions looked as if nobody had told them that they weren't still in the exhibition season. What happened in Miami on Halloween?
Well, I think they were misinformed that there was going to be a basketball game after the ring ceremony because they didn't come out and play. Pat Riley has taken a really good attitude towards this. I mean, look, it was your one, this is the one you get. This is your 2006-2007 mulligan, boys. Mm-hmm. But now it's time to play a little bit better.
Elsewhere in Florida basketball, on Monday night, an Orlando Magic fan found himself without a seat and without his season ticket and unwelcome anywhere else in the NBA as well. What did Houman Hamzalui do to deserve banishment as well as ejection?
Well, he called Dikembe Mutombo a monkey. And there's already people circling the wagon saying he didn't realize it was a racial slur. You can't live in the United States of America for 15 minutes without realizing calling an African-American a monkey is a racial slur. I don't buy that at all. There are going to be, we're going to have one of these fake free speech kerfuffles that explode for a while. Just as we are going to have one, by the way, in Cincinnati, where a radio sports commentator named Andy Furman got fired from his talk show for calling T.J. Houshmandzadeh a racist. But the account of this event says there all you need to know about a lot of the culture of sports talk radio in this country. Furman, along with other WLW personalities, has a history of making controversial and inflammatory comments on the air. The station has led the Cincinnati area ratings for more than 6 years, according to the paper. One follows the other.
The NBA has implemented a new rule this season, Charlie. It's aimed at curbing displays of outrage when players are whistled for fouls. On Wednesday night, the Detroit Pistons' Rasheed Wallace, for whom the new rule is informally named, was ejected for complaining to officials. Has any other NBA player ever been ejected for violating a rule that was named for him?
Oh, let me see. I don't know any other rules that were named for players. I mean, there were the Jordan rules, but that involved how Detroit played the Bulls. First of all, it's a dumb rule. Get competent referees and you won't have people making faces at them. Second of all, Rasheed Wallace was being lit up at the time by Charlie Villanueva and so was probably, you know, making faces at him more than he was making faces at the referee. This will happen more than three or four times this year. Rasheed Wallace will be involved in at least 70%, I would say, of the incidents.
I think I've thought of another example. The next time Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban is fined, will it be because he's broken the Mark Cuban rule?
Yes, I think it will be. And boy, do I like this one. I know he's got a lot of money. I know he keeps a blog. I know young people really think he's cool. But here's a tip from Mark Cuban. Nobody goes to the arena to watch the owner. And nobody goes to the arena, especially, to watch the owner be a jackass.
The New York Knicks bought out Jalen Rose this week, apparently because he was too expensive, but they had to pay almost as much to cut him as they would have had to pay if they still had him on the bench. Help me with the math here.
Well, this is just another masterpiece from front office genius Isaiah Thomas. They owed Jalen Rose $16.9 million. They paid him $14 million to go away. He will catch on with somebody. He's still got game left, and I hope he comes back and gets about 50 against the Knicks.
And finally, Charlie, John Bain of Wilmington, Delaware, has built a rubber band ball that weighs 3,300 pounds, and apparently he's not satisfied with that achievement.
Some week, I'm warning you right now, these stories are going to be greeted with dead silence from the other microphone. What does this have to do with sports?
It's a record. It's a record. Set a record.
So is Wishbone Ash Live, but we don't talk about it on this show.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine in his new book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything, is on the bookshelves even as we speak. Charlie joins me each week at this time. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
During his 9 seasons as a fullback for the Cleveland Browns, Jim Brown established himself as a superb professional football player. Though his records have since fallen to running backs who played for more than 9 years, Brown is still considered by some to be the game's greatest ball carrier. According to Mike Freeman, who has recently written a biography of Jim Brown, the former fullback is also an American hero. Mike Freeman joins me now from New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
Jim Brown retired after the 1965 season. What led you to write this book about him 41 years after he last carried a football?
I think he's the most compelling athletic figure that I've ever been around. I've been in sports full-time now for 20 years and grew up playing sports, and he was always my favorite guy and always my, just to me, a guy that I admired. Even though he had great flaws, he also had a lot of greatness in other areas. And to me, this is a book that I just, my whole life, I've been waiting to write. Once I got old enough and good enough to write it, I was going to write it. But also, I think that his, what he did with his life and his greatness, not just on the playing field but off of it, has almost been forgotten. And he was, to me, he's the greatest athlete ever in any sport. So I wanted to make sure that his life and what he did was not forgotten.
Jim Brown left the game long before he had to. In fact, he caught the Cleveland Browns by surprise when he declined to return to the team for the 66 season. He said he wanted to go out on top, and then years later he threatened to return to the National Football League. Why?
You know what? That situation, when you go back and you look, do the research on it and you talk to people about it, he really wasn't serious about coming back. It was sort of a typical Jim Brown moment. He wanted to just tweak the current players. What Jim was upset about was the way players he thought, especially running backs like Franco Harris at the time, were soft. He thought they got soft. He thought that instead of taking a hit, they would run out of bounds. When Jim Brown played, you didn't do that. And everything in Jim Brown's career and life, when he talks about today's players, he remembers what it was like then. So those days are still alive in his head. And really, when he left football, I mean, you can't, it's hard to sort of imagine just how what he did, how significant it was, because he left football on top, but he also left football to start a movie career. It would be like Tom Brady winning a Super Bowl and then going to star in a movie with Cameron Diaz.
Jim Brown has said that although he did not participate in marches or sit-ins, he has been very active in the fight for civil rights. Is that a fair contention?
I think it is. He went into, he initially was called the Black Economic Union, and even before that it was called the Negro Industrial Economic Union. He wanted to use the clout of athletes and their popularity, sort of gather it together and form a business in which mostly people of color would get business loans and business advice from this group. And, I mean, you can't really put into words just how unique and how important it was. And Jim Brown always, he's quoted a lot as saying he was not going to march because athletes couldn't do that. That's something I disagree with.
Well, but a lot of athletes have done that. That's what strikes me as peculiar about that contention.
A lot have done it. His whole thing is more the way to really help people is not march, but get their money right. He didn't deride people necessarily who marched and who did that sort of thing. I think he saw that as important, but it was more that the way to gain true equality is through finances, and that's what he tried to do. How successful it was is still something that is up for debate. I happen to think just trying it made it very successful, but others sort of saw it as something that was just sort of serving his ego. But I don't think that was it at all. I think he was really trying to economically empower people, and he saw this organization as a way to do it.
You acknowledge that Jim Brown had and perhaps still has a terrible temper, and as you put it, quote, when it comes to relationships, he has a need to conquer. Though he denies committing some of the violent acts with which he has been charged, he acknowledges that he has assaulted women and that he fairly recently smashed the windows of his wife's car with a shovel. He's also acknowledged that he provided cocaine to women he was dating, as you write, as a lure and to help them perform. How are these the acts of a hero?
Well, that's the part of the book that I had the toughest time with. He has a track record of being accused of abusing women going back a long time. There was a big trial in Cleveland, in fact, in which a woman accused him of assaulting her, and it turned out to be false. And, in fact, many times the women who accuse him end up not, in the end, prosecuting him and cooperating with authorities.
This, of course, is not unusual in cases of assault.
No, it's not unusual in cases of domestic violence overall. In 1990, he again was accused of using a shovel after getting in an argument with his wife, Monique.
Let me just hold up for a minute there. He wasn't accused of taking a shovel to his wife's car.
No, he did it.
That's
what I mean.
I mean, the glass was broken all over the place, and she called 911. So this was not just an accusation.
No, he did it. He did it. And then he ended up going into prison when a judge ordered him to community service and pick up garbage on the side of the road. You know, Jim Brown was not picking up garbage on the side of the road. So he said, send me to prison, and he went to prison. And I write in the book, sometimes you wish Jim Brown would just say, you know, I screwed up, I'm sorry. He won't. He just won't do it. And this is where I spent months sort of debating how to frame this. And I've taken some heat for it, but I stand by it in that I think the good things that he has done outweigh the horrible things he's done.
I just wonder if, given what you said at the beginning of our conversation, that you had really grown up idolizing Jim Brown, the football player, if that simply colored everything else that you had to say about him. Because the book reads as if you wrote it with a determination to come to the conclusion that he was a hero.
Actually, when I was growing up admiring him, I didn't know much about him and some of the darker parts of his life. I didn't know a lot about that stuff. I admired him more as a football player. Mm-hmm. And then as I began to read up on his life, I admired him for other reasons. you know, I had someone close to me say, if he had beaten up your daughter or your wife, you wouldn't be calling him a hero. And that's a very fair point. But there's lots of flawed heroes. And we sort of pick and choose the foibles or the really bad things they do. We will forget it or overlook with some people, and some people we won't. We're just human beings. We're just like that. And maybe I'm guilty of overlooking too much some of the things he's done. But I do think, even though the book is mostly positive about him, I do think I present it realistically. I present everything he's done that I could verify, mm-hmm. everything. And there are things that I heard that he's done that I couldn't verify. I just couldn't put it in the book because I have a fear of lawyers.
Well, and a fear of Jim Brown. There's a bit at the end where you say, "I hope he doesn't come, you know, track me down and punch me out if he doesn't like the book."
That's a little facetious, but I might be able to take Jim Brown now because he is 70, so I'm not as fearful of him beating me up. But I'm interested to see how he reacts to this. We spoke about it. We didn't speak about the book. I've interviewed him before. But he wouldn't really, in typical Jim Brown fashion, I think he wanted to more control of the book than I was willing to give up.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be interesting to see how he responds to it. But there's going to be a lot of people who feel the way you do, that question, how can you call a guy a hero when he's done some of these really horrific things? That's something that will define sort of Jim Brown's career, that question.
Mike Freeman is the author of Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero, published by Morrow. He spoke to me from New York. Mike, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Elias Feldman, the fine folks at WUGA in Athens, Georgia, and our old friend Nancy Greenlease. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view our photo galleries of Kenyan runners and dueling Zambonis, these are separate galleries, I assure you, learn more about Jim Brown, The Fierce Life of an American Hero, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Buffalo Sabres right winger Maxim Afinigainov, because we just had to hear that sports cliche of sports cliches once more in Russian.
Одна игра за одной.
Of course, we're assuming he said just take it one game at a time. He could have been telling me that if I didn't leave him alone, he was going to remove my spleen with a blade of his stick. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at DigitalLearning.MacFound.org. This is NPR.